and presided over by people like Leonardo da Vinci and Sir Isaac Newton. It's completely bogus. And you can see these, quote, ancient documents in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, and they'll show them to you, and of course, and they will explain to you that they're only about 50 years old and full of mistakes, as the forgers attempted to imitate a very old form of the French language and some Latin and so on. But Dan Brown is naive, and so you have a huge mistake. And in this book, it goes on to talk about Emperor Constantine choosing the Gospels in the New Testament. And again, it's a very naive application of some dubious ideas floating around by Michael Bagent and others, and some people even with a little bit of scholarly training, who think that that there are other Gospels that give us a truer glimpse of Jesus. And so this is a major issue. Well, what about the four Gospels that are in the New Testament? Can we trust them? Can we trust the Gospels? Or should we actually look elsewhere? Should we look at the Gospel of Thomas, which is much beloved by members of the Jesus Seminar? And it's the Gospel of Thomas that gets a lot of press. I know it's been eclipsed somewhat in the last 2 years by the Gospel of Judas. Has anybody here not heard of the Gospel of Judas in the last 2 years? Oh, don't raise your hand if you haven't. Don't admit it. But the Gospel of Judas, I mean, you know, what is this stuff? The Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Thomas, and some other writings, including the secret Gospel of Mark. And so what's been going on for the last 20 years or so has been a resurgence of interest in scholarly and non-scholarly circles, interest in these writings that were not included in the New Testament. And the implication is that there's some kind of conspiracy. Emperor Constantine or the church or somebody is trying to hide alternate accounts of the life of Jesus. And we've got this sanitized, selected number of Gospels that give us a certain, quote, orthodox view of Jesus. But you know, that really isn't the truth. There's really more to it than that. And so the Sunday school Jesus, the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that's just the church's interpretation. There actually is another Jesus out there who's far more interesting. And that Jesus is attested in other Gospels, like Thomas or Peter or Judas or Philip or even the Gospel of Mary. And the church, it's a papal conspiracy. The church does not want you to know that. See, and this is the overlay. And in popular circles, it comes into expression like Da Vinci Code. In semi-pseudo-scholarship, it comes across with Michael Bagent and his Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Holy Smokes. It comes across in even what looks like scholarly stuff by the Jesus Seminar. So we're going to talk about that. Can we trust the Gospels? You betcha, we sure can. I'll tell you right now, the New Testament Gospels are first century. And these other Gospels are 2nd and 3rd century. Now, I just said something that, in my mind, I trained in history before going into biblical studies. In my mind, what I just said to you makes a lot of sense. The New Testament Gospels are 1st century. The other Gospels are 2nd and 3rd. My wife, when I was writing Fabricating Jesus, I kept saying that from time to time. Well, you know, these Gospels are 1st century and these other Gospels are 2nd or 3rd. And my wife says, you know, there are going to be a lot of readers out there that do not know the significance of that. And I was in one of those shock moments. No, 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 tell me it's not so. That can't be true. Anybody who can read a book would know. No, she says, they won't understand the point that you're assuming. So I had my wife read each chapter it was written. And she'd throw these things at me, and it's a better book because of it. So I wrote a couple of paragraphs explaining why first century Gospels or any first century source about first century events is to be preferred over second and third century sources talking about a first century event, in this case, Jesus of Nazareth. And when the publisher got that chapter, one of the comments, they said, you know, we like this chapter, especially those paragraphs where you explain what the significance is of 1st, 2nd, 3rd century. And I'm just, oh my goodness, my goodness. So please, I mean, maybe everyone in this room understands the significance, but just keep that in mind. we're dealing with a society that doesn't think very clearly. I mean, never underestimate the lack of knowledge and content and reasoning. We're in a postmodern society that tends to be irrational and highly subjective. And so when you talk about, well, you know, one of the reasons I like the Gospels in the New Testament, the reason the church held on to these particular Gospels is because they were written in the first century within a generation of the time of Jesus and his original followers. They're written close in time when eyewitnesses are still living. Any historian will tell you that sources that go back that far, that close to the event, are to be preferred over sources that are 100 years or even later removed. And just to clarify this, I'm going to share with you an experience that I had with somebody that just blew me out of the water. I'm not making this up. This is not a joke. You're not going to find it online or in any collection of funny stories. This happened to me and my wife about 4 years ago when we were in England. We were in the Cotswolds. My wife's in love with the place. This is where we live in our hearts. Anyway, we're in the Cotswolds, which, as you know, is west of London in a beautiful area. Anyway, we're at a bed and breakfast. And you know how that routine goes. And so in the morning, we come downstairs and we sit at a table, and a couple from Northern England were brought in, and they sat at the table with us. And our hosts very graciously introduced everybody to kind of break the ice and get people talking. So she introduced Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so to us, and Mr. So-and-so is a retired engineer. This man has a university education, retired engineer, and Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, here is Professor Craig Evans and his wife, Jenny. And Professor Evans, you know, because we'd been talking before, you know, he teaches New Testament, and he's an expert in the historical Jesus. So then she leaves us to go get juice and coffee and so on. And so the retired engineer says, oh, so you're interested in the historical Jesus? And I said, uh-huh. Well, he says, you know what, I've recently gained some insight into Jesus. I said, oh, really? And I thought, well, this is an interesting way for the conversation to get underway. And he says, you know, the wife and I were in Rome a couple of years ago. And when we got there, I looked around and I saw all these churches, all this religious art, these statues and everything. And then it hit me. Ha! No wonder when Jesus visited Rome, no wonder he got interested in religion. I'm not making that up. I wish I was. My wife later said, how did you keep a straight face? I said, I was in shock. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? How can anyone in this day and age with a university education have such ignorance in terms of history? Jesus saw churches in Rome and got interested in religion. If that doesn't win the prize... Well, if an educated person, university degree, does not understand that, how in the world is he going to pick up a copy of Da Vinci Code and see anything wrong with it? That Dan Brown's silly fact page, which is nothing but errors, with the exception that Opus Dei really did build a building in New York, that was right. But how could he read with any discernment? When he turns on the television and watches a documentary and some Jesus seminar guy is telling us that the Gospel of Thomas gives us the real truth, or at last we know about Judas Iscariot because of the Gospel of Judas, and even if it's admitted, well, you know, it wasn't written until about A.D. 160, how would this guy see any problem? My wife was right. You got to talk about this first, second century, third century. Because this fellow, this retired engineer, university-educated person sitting at that breakfast table in the B&B, he does not have a clue about historical sequence, chronology, or anything like that. Now, he may be able to say all kinds of things about engineering, but he doesn't know anything about history, and I wager not much about documents either. So can we trust the Gospels? Yes, but we better understand them. We have biblical illiteracy in the church, not just general society. People don't actually know what's in the Bible. I've had, I won't even go there, dismal conversations with brand new students. One of them was pretty smart. He knew that Moses was in the Old Testament. Well, that was a big step in the right direction. There's intellectual... My laser pointer, I think, is getting a little tired. There's intellectual relativity. Truth is private and personal. Your truth is no better than my truth. Well, we've all heard that in one form or another in recent years. Ahistoricism, what happened a long time ago doesn't really matter. That's the other thing on this gospel stuff. Talking about first, second, third, fourth century dates for texts, I've had people say things like, well, isn't new better? Think about that. What's wrong with a third century gospel? It's newer. May still be under warranty. Oh, my. And the moral relativity, of course, we know the problem there. Nothing's absolute. You know, hey, we don't need these rules. That's for a long time ago. And, of course, we have apostates. Oh, boy, the media, the secular media loves an apostate. Bart Ehrman, of course, has been the champion relating to my field, New Testament studies, misquoting Jesus. He doesn't trust the New Testament manuscripts any longer. You know, in my black bag back there, you'll find a metal cigar-shaped laser pointer. You'll see it pinned at the top. Okay. It will be helpful to use it. Thanks, Rick. I'm sorry. Sometimes in security, they open my bag and say, what's that? So I just point at it. I said, that's what it is. Laser pointer. Looks like a weapon. Anyway. So, and then, of course, Bart Ehrman, who has no training at all in philosophy, has written a philosophical book. It's in the area we call theodicy. That is questions about God and justice. And it's called God's Problem. Oh, yes, he says, I can't trust Scripture anymore because it's got scribal errors in it. And that's a lot of nonsense, by the way. Of course the scribes make mistakes, but serious textual critics don't have any doubt at all about the contents of Scripture, don't have any doubt at all that the biblical writings that we possess today, in fact, reflect what the authors originally wrote. They have no serious doubt about that. Anyone will tell you we have 99.99% of the original text, maybe even 100%. And Bart Ehrman makes a big deal out of scribal errors in the manuscripts. That is such a red herring. Well, now he gives us a philosophy book, and he talks about the problem of evil and suffering in the world. How could a good God allow this? And the book is poorly written, and he doesn't cite any of the scholars and philosophers who down through the centuries have given very learned thought to this question and have provided very compelling answers. But, oh, he's the media darling because of his skepticism. So major publishing houses bring out his books, and there you'll see them in Barnes & Noble on display. It is quite sad. So our challenge is proclaiming the gospel to a subjective, not always rational population. Identify the problems, consider the approaches, look for points of connection, or what is being emphasized in this conference, and that is get into the conversation. Look for the points where you can converse and talk and able to do things like emphasize the truth. Sometimes you can shock people by saying, you know what, I believe there is truth. I believe there really is a right and wrong. I mean, you may as well. God has left his fingerprints on the human heart. The human beings instinctively know there is such a thing as right and wrong. So go ahead, you're cheating. You got God on your side at that point. Just say there is truth. There are rights and wrongs. And every human being on this planet knows that. Every culture and every society in all times and generations know that is so. Reach out with integrity and consistency. People notice hypocrisy and they don't like it. They may be hypocrites themselves, but they see it in others and they don't like it. And in my experience, that's what's harmed the church's witness more than anything else. It's just, you know, as one person put it, he says, well, I know this person who's a Christian, and he's not any different from anyone else I know. And that's got to be the worst thing that can be said about the church. What's the difference? There are some great books out there. That one is a classic, the top one, Richard Middleton and Brian Walls. Truth is stranger than it used to be. And that's a good book. All of these by InterVarsity Press. My colleague, longtime colleague at Trinity Western University, Paul Chamberlain, Can We Be Good Without God? Talking about good and bad without getting ugly. Very clever. So how are we responding? Well, the point today for me is the reliability of the Gospels and the other books of Scripture too, the true historical context of the story of Jesus in the early church, the reliability of the biblical manuscripts. We do, in fact, have the original words. And then the clarifying and confirming value of history and archaeology. I'm just going to hit a few of these highlights, and I would be interested very much in some time for Q&A. So we respond to the extreme, and that's a book I wish I had here for you to pick up. It's now out in paper as well. It came out in 2006, but I have a fact page in it. I couldn't help it. I had to write a fact page to counter Dan Brown's fact page in his Da Vinci Code. Well, Dan has his facts. I have facts too, but mine are a bit more factual, if you please. They're actually backed up with real documents, not phony ones, not hoaxes. The Gospels I talk about are more than 50 years old. They reach back to the first century. The reliability of the Gospels, a major affirmation by this fellow right here, Richard Bauckham, longtime professor of New Testament at St. Andrews University in Scotland, now in semi-retirement in Cambridge. Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, an outstanding book published by Erdmans. So if you really want to get into a learned discussion of this issue, and it is a big discussion, 500 pages, a serious book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, but he makes a compelling case that the Gospels reflect eyewitness tradition, and he even talks about who's named and why. You ever wonder about that? Why do these names pop up suddenly? Why are we told that Simon of Cyrene, who helped Jesus carry the cross, has two sons named Rufus and Alexander? Why? Why are some people named and some people unnamed? It's a fascinating account where he talks about eyewitnesses who are still living and are being protected, and so their names aren't mentioned. Others who are deceased and their names are mentioned. It's a fascinating read, but a very learned read, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. Papias, a church father at the beginning of the second century, writes about actually encountering eyewitnesses, people who knew the apostles. Folks, this tradition that's being quoted there, I'm not going to read it, but that tradition dates to at the very beginning of the second century. Here is a person who knew people who knew the apostles, whose memory goes back to the very people who saw Jesus, saw his teaching, heard his teaching, memorized it, passed it on, were alive when the Gospels were written. And Papias affirms the accuracy and the authority of the tradition that is contained in the four Gospels. And by the way, Papias never heard of the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Judas or any of these others. These were written much, much later. The four Gospels of the New Testament are the only four Gospels anybody even knows of at the beginning of the second century. They're the only Gospels anybody quotes. They're the four Gospels that are harmonized by Tatian in the middle of the second century. They're the only Gospels that are ever harmonized and grouped together or commented upon or quoted by anybody up until the middle of the second century. That is a point that is lost on some of these skeptics. The four Gospels of the New Testament are the old ones, the known ones, the respected ones, the ones with credible connection to the Lord's disciples. Papias is writing at the beginning of the second century. He's talking about his youth in the 80s. He had access to people who knew the apostles. Wouldn't you like to have that privilege too? Can you imagine that? Sit down with some people that knew the apostle John or knew Peter or knew Matthew. Actually sit down and say, yes, that's right. This is what they taught. This is what they said. Well, that's what we have in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Paul himself was converted within 2 or 3 years of the time of Jesus' resurrection. There are two dates for the resurrection, either 30 or 33, and scholars are evenly divided on that. if it was 33. Paul's a Christian in the year 35. So Paul, you see, is a convert. He meets with the apostles themselves. He talks about the pillars of the church, Galatians chapters 1 and 2, who extended to him the right hand of fellowship, acknowledged that Paul's understanding of the gospel was right on the money. And Paul, even though he had a vision himself directly with Christ, many visions, in fact, but of course the one we always talk about, the road on the road to Damascus, Paul nonetheless felt it was important to lay his understanding of the gospel before the original apostles of Jesus. And this is in just a few years' time of Easter. The apostles are still living. And we have from Paul 13 writings. This is from a man who saw the risen Jesus himself, who conversed with the apostles who knew Jesus and followed him before the Passion Week. And we have his writings. The New Testament is filled with eyewitness material that can't be underestimated. We're not talking about secondhand references to Paul. We have his writings. We must say no to these other gospels. Why would we say yes to them? When in the New Testament we have four first century gospels, we have 13 first century writings of an eyewitness, a person who met the risen Jesus, a person who actually knew his apostles. Why would we ignore those writings in the New Testament and say yes to writings like the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Peter? And by the way, nobody thinks Peter actually wrote it or Thomas wrote Thomas. Or the secret Gospel of Mark. Let's do a quick review of these. Let's drive this point home. Remember that some of these oddball views of Jesus bandied about in the media. And oh, by the way, just days ago, CBC, at taxpayer expense, aired that ridiculous documentary, Tom Harper's Pagan Christ. Did any of you happen to notice it? Yeah, I'm not asking you if you watched it, but did you happen to? For Pete's sakes. CBC aired it originally in December. I mean, the timing, isn't that choice? December. They aired it in December of 07. They're airing it now late November of 08. Maybe they'll show it again. Maybe Christmas Eve. Tom Harper's The Pagan Christ. I've debated Tom on radio. That book, there is nothing in it that has any credibility at all. If you know what theosophy is centered on this idea of an Egyptian idea about religion. It's an Egyptian myth. And so Jesus is just a created individual. He never existed. He's just made up. He's a fairy tale that embodies, like a parable, embodies this Egyptian mythology that theosophy is so fond of. How in the world Tom Harper bought into this, an intelligent, educated man, I don't know. It's most strange. CBC contacted me in the spring, I think it was, of 07, and said they were planning to do this documentary on Tom Harper's Pagan Christ, and I begged them not to do it. I said, that's a shameful waste of taxpayers' money. There isn't any credibility behind this. Please talk to, if you don't want to believe me, talk to any two or three bona fide historians on faculties, university faculties in Canada. Talk to a few historians. They'll say the same thing. There's nothing to this. Now, I don't know to whom they spoke, but anyway, they decided to go ahead and make the documentary, and now they've aired it. I mean, this Tom Harper's Pagan Christ makes this stuff look credible. That is so far off. And that's where our society is. Taxpayer-funded documentary on Tom Harper's Pagan Christ, as if it actually, the theory, has any credibility at all. It's just, that's where our society is. Well, let's take a quick review of these Gospels. So we start with the Queen of the Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas. The Jesus Seminar has a book called The Five Gospels. Now you know which Gospel is the fifth Gospel. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas. Thomas was found, we didn't realize that's what it was initially, but in 1896, three Greek fragments were found. And then 50 years later, in the 1940s, the whole thing was found in translation, in Coptic translation. Coptic is the Egyptian language using the Greek alphabet. And then we realized, oh, this is the Gospel of Thomas the church fathers back in the 2nd and 3rd centuries talk about. So we found the Gospel of Thomas, and this is where we found some of it at Oxyrhynchus. I tell my students, if you can spell that word, you get an A. Anyway, ancient city back in the times of the early church. And that's the Nile River Delta. You can see the Nile. The Nile River flows from south to north, and then it empties into the Mediterranean. There's Alexandria over there, and then there is Oxyrhynchus here on the Nile. And so at a place near this cliff, a jar was found, and several old books were found in it. And one of the books contains this document right here, and you can see where it says, the Gospel according to Thomas, at the conclusion of it. And so now we had the whole thing. So we have a Coptic translation of the Gospel of Thomas. You know the Thomas legend. Thomas is the doubter. Jesus invites Thomas to thrust his hand into his side, the wound of the side. You can see these famous pieces of artwork. There he is poking his finger into Jesus' wounded side. Here he is. Thomas is such a skeptic, he's actually examining the spear to make sure it fits the wound, I guess. In any case, in the Jesus scholars, the Jesus seminar, we have Thomas supporters. And these names and people you'll see many times when we consider these things. But what you're looking at there on the far left is my friend, long time. We played basketball together when we were PhD students, and that's Marvin Meyer. He's my Coptic teacher here, Charlie Hedrick. And there, of course, is John Dominic Crossan, the Irish-American who is interviewed almost always on these various documentaries. They, of course, think that the Gospel of Thomas is just as old as the Gospels in the New Testament. Even though it's a second century document, they believe there was an earlier form of it that existed in the first century. And it actually gives us a better insight into who Jesus really was. It gives us a Jesus freed up from the church image that we have of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So they think Thomas needs to be lionized and emphasized. Well, I don't think so. Now let's take a quick look at Thomas, and I'll tell you what I think Thomas really is. First of all, Thomas the esoteric. That is, Thomas and keeping secrets. Thomas and with information only for the privileged insider. Look how it begins. These are the secret words that the living Jesus spoke. And it goes on to say that those who discover the meaning of his words, his teachings, then they will have huge insight and they will reign over the all. Okay? And so then we have 114 sayings. Then it concludes. And so this is an esoteric orientation. Now, is this the real Jesus, the public Jesus who goes about teaching? No. This is a very different Jesus we have. So hold that thought. Jesus and the esoteric. How about the ascetic? Buyers and merchants will not enter the places of my Father, Thomas says, or is this Jesus? Saying number 64. And then the very next saying, number 65, is a familiar parable of the vineyard tenants. But notice a change. Does anyone see a difference? If you look up Mark chapter 12, verse 1, you won't read anything about a money lender. You'll have a man who owned a vineyard and took care of it and prepared it and leased it out and went away and expected to collect fruit. But no. In Thomas, it's a money lender owned a vineyard and leased it to some farmers. Do you notice that? Buyers and merchants will not enter heaven. Let me tell you a story about a merchant, a buyer, a lender, who hoped to make a profit on a vineyard. And we know how it turned out. He received no profit. And even when he sent his own son to collect what was owed, his son was murdered. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Hear what? Thomas's message. And what's Thomas's message? Anti-commercial, anti-material, anti-bourgeois. What's going on here? Thomas is into the esoteric. Thomas is into the ascetic. Severe treatment of the body. Repudiation of comforts and material wealth. What's going on? Oh, by the way, Thomas knows half of the books of the New Testament. You know the significance of this? If you were to go back in time, all the way back to the end of the first century, that far back, and started visiting churches, you would be lucky to find a single church that had in its possession half of the books of the New Testament. Do you realize how rich we are in resources in comparison? You walk into the pastor's office and you'll see some books on the shelves, and you will see a library that no church possessed in the first or second, or probably not even in the third century. You'll see Bibles lying around with every single book of the Old Testament and the New Testament. You know what a precious treasure that would have been back then? Thomas knows half of the writings of the New Testament. Thomas even knows details in the New Testament, specific details that show up, for example, in Luke or in Matthew. How in the world can we explain that? Thomas seems to be familiar with a harmony. You know what a harmonization, or where you take the three synoptics or all four of the Gospels and you blend them together? They're available. You can go to a bookstore and buy one. So you have one Gospel to read and all the details of all four Gospels are merged together. Well, this was being done in the second century. And a fellow named Tatian wrote one, remerged the four Gospels together. They called it the Diatessaron. Do you realize the author of the Gospel of Thomas knows this work? There's a problem here. The work didn't get finished until about 175 AD. Isn't that a dead giveaway of the date? If the Gospel of Thomas knows a writing that was produced in 175 AD, how does Thomas get dated so early? Thomas is familiar with other Syrian tradition. Did you know that Syrian Christians, the Eastern Church at that time, did you know they were into esoteric ideas? Did you know they were into asceticism? Oh my. And did you know they called Thomas, Doubting Thomas, Thomas Judas Didymus, or Judas Didymus Thomas? That was one of their favorite ways of referring to him. That's exactly how he's referred to in the Gospel of Thomas. Do you realize that all of this keeps pointing in one direction? The Gospel of Thomas is late. Thomas probably contains little or no authentic material beyond what we find in the New Testament Gospels themselves. This kind of evidence is not taken seriously. It's either not known at all, or ignored, or underrated by some of those who say the Gospel of Thomas is early, as early as the New Testament Gospels, gives us a Jesus we should take seriously. Perhaps a Jesus who is superior to the Jesus found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. How about the Gospel of Peter? This one's a corker. It's one of my favorites. It was found in a wooden coffin dating to the 9th century. A 9th century Egyptian Christian monk was found in a coffin, all shriveled up, and in with him was an old book, and in this old book was part of a long-lost gospel that some think could be the Gospel of Peter, a fictional work written under Peter's name at the end of the 2nd century. Okay, and there are actually a couple of pages of it right there in the center. All right. And maybe a few more pieces of Greek papyri relating to it. And, of course, the usual suspects who think the Gospel of Peter gives us a very early account. An early account of Jesus' death and resurrection. Oh, it's an interesting account. How early it is much in doubt. But it's definitely an interesting account. Now, of course, these fellows say that the Gospel of Peter gives us an account of Jesus' resurrection that is older than what we have in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In fact, they go on to say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John made use of this Gospel of Peter. Well, did they? Let's test that. Well, whoever wrote this book, if it is the Gospel of Peter, we don't know for sure, by the way, if it is. But let's just assume it is. Whoever wrote this Gospel of Peter does not understand Jewish customs. And you'll see why in just a moment. I'm going to describe its account of the resurrection. You're going to love it. He doesn't understand Jewish customs. Whoever wrote this doesn't even understand who rules Jerusalem at the time Jesus was put to death. Pontius Pilate was the ruler. But the author of this work, the Gospel of Peter, isn't real sure. He doesn't know if it's Herod Antipas or if it's Pilate. He's unclear. How could anybody writing in the first century not know that? But writing at the end of the second century, yeah, I can understand that confusion. Whoever wrote this is influenced by the way Matthew tells the story. Oh, that's interesting. And whoever wrote it even is anti-Semitic. Really? This sounds like a Gentile writing much later who's angry at the Jewish people. Doesn't sound like an authentic first century source. And therefore, there are many scholars around the world who seriously doubt that this writing contains an early version, a more original version of Jesus' death and resurrection. Well, my conclusions regarding Peter is that this is not an early work. There are secondary editorial touches, historical and cultural blunders, anti-Semitic tendencies, and fantastic elements. What am I talking about? Let me share them with you. How does the story go? Well, according to the Gospel of Peter, Jesus is put to death and he's buried. And so his critics then say, the ruling priests say, we need to post a guard, a very large guard at the tomb, lest his disciples come and steal away his body and claim that he's been resurrected. Now you hear that and you think, that sounds like the Gospel of Matthew. Yes, it does. I'm sure that's where it comes from. And so Pilate says, go ahead, post a guard. And so not only is there a large Roman guard guarding the tomb of Jesus, but the Jewish people themselves, the elders and scribes and maybe even some of the ruling priests, they guard the tomb too. Now, folks, think about this. Whoever is coming up with this scenario does not understand Jewish customs. No Jewish person spends the night in the cemetery. Nobody spends a three-day weekend in the cemetery. Nobody pitches a tent, rolls out a sleeping bag, roasts some marshmallows in a cemetery Friday night, throughout the Sabbath, right on into Saturday night, on into Sunday morning. This is ludicrous. And yet the Gospel of Peter, whoever wrote it, doesn't seem to have a problem with this. And so we have Roman troops and we have Jewish elders and ruling priests spending the night that weekend keeping an eye on Jesus' tomb. This whole scenario is ridiculous. But then the resurrection takes place early Sunday morning. There's an earthquake. There's a shout. The stone rolls aside. Everybody wakes up. All these hostile witnesses now are watching. And two men descend from heaven. They're really tall. And they come down to the earth and they go into the tomb. And then there's a shout and the two men come out of the tomb. And between them is a third man. That's Jesus, of course. And the heads of the two men, angels no doubt, their heads reach up into the clouds. Can you imagine how tall they are? And the head of the third man between them being assisted, his head actually goes up above the clouds. Can you imagine that? This is an, you know, get them on the Raptors. This is an NBA dream team. Wow. I think it's Jesus. And so these three guys come out of the tomb, and you know what else comes out of the tomb? The cross. The cross on which Jesus had been crucified. The cross. Who put the cross in the tomb? Why would the cross be in the tomb? How would you get the cross in a tomb? Do you know the real size of the entrances to these tombs? Basically a meter square, slightly larger than a meter square. How would this cross get into this tomb? Was it hinged? I mean, how, you know, is the tomb even long enough to accommodate this cross? How did the cross, why would anyone put the cross in the tomb with Jesus? I mean, what'd somebody say? Oh, you know, let's put the cross in with him. Yeah, it's his favorite. I mean, the whole thing is silly. Now, there is an explanation for this coming up. But this whole thing, so the cross now, however it got in, whyever it was put in, comes out of the tomb and follows the three men. How does a cross walk? Do you ever think of that? A walking cross? I mean, what has it got, a roller skate on the end? Or is it a pogo stick? Hey, slow down. I only got one leg. I mean, how does a cross walk after somebody? And then a voice from heaven says, now this is, you can read it for yourself. This is the text. I'm summarizing it very accurately. A voice from heaven says, have you preached to them that sleep? Now, I'll not ask the pastor of this church if he does that routinely on Sundays. But in any case, have you preached to them that sleep? And you know who answers that question? Is it Jesus who's being assisted by the two tall angels? No. Is it one of the angels? No. The cross answers. The cross says, yes. The cross did the preaching. The cross can not only walk, it can talk. That'll give you a new thought the next time you sing that wonderful hymn, He Walks With Me and Talks With Me. Who, Jesus or the cross? In any case, this is absurd. And yet with all seriousness, crossing, Dewey, and a few of the others in the Jesus seminar will say, this Gospel of Peter and its talking cross is the early source, the early account of Jesus' death and resurrection on which Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are based. Oh, you must be kidding me. By the way, the reason I don't accept that for one second, besides the ridiculosity of it, is that the idea of the cross going with Jesus wherever he goes, including his ascension, is a later Christian idea in the second and third centuries. It's not a first century idea. It's a second and third century idea. The Gospel of Peter, indeed, if it is the Gospel of Peter, belongs to this period of time, late second century, early third. This is not an early source that gives us the truth at long last. A source that is older than the four Gospels we have in the New Testament? Not at all. But my favorite is the secret gospel of Mark. Morton Smith says he found it at the Marsaba Monastery, which is in the Judean wilderness, equidistant between Jerusalem and the Dead Sea. And there it is, the center picture. I've been there, the Marsaba Monastery. You can actually look right across. It's the Kidron Valley is what it is, as it goes east from Jerusalem, winds its way across the Judean desert, and finally empties into the Dead Sea. Halfway there, on the southern bank, is this Greek Orthodox monastery called Marsaba. Morton Smith says that he was there in 1958, and he was, and he found written in the back of a book 2.5 pages of Greek text, supposedly a long-lost letter of Clement of Alexandria, a letter that probably dates to about the end of the 2nd century AD. And in this letter, a secret version of Mark, not the Mark you have in your Bible, but a secret version of Mark, a longer Gospel of Mark, is referred to and even quoted a couple of passages. Morton Smith says he believes it's authentic. Some people think he wrote it. This is the end of the book, the last page right there on the left. And here's a color picture, life-size color photos, finally were published only about 5 years ago. And here it is. That's page one, and then page two, and then page three, which abruptly ends in mid-sentence. Ah. So do we really have here hints, genuine hints, and even two quotations of a form of the Gospel of Mark a bit longer than the one we have that is original, that describes Jesus in the nude, instructing other nude men? Salacious, odd stuff here. What is this? Oh, did I forget to mention Morton Smith was gay? In any case, it goes on. Here's how the letter begins, translated. It says, from the letters of the most holy Clement, author of Stromates, to Theodore. You did well in silencing the unspeakable teachings of the Carpocratians, for they are the wandering stars referred to in prophecy. And he goes on to talk about the Gospel of Mark, which they misrepresent. And he goes on to say there really is a secret or mystical version of Mark that has other stuff in it. And then here is the story where Jesus in the nude receives a man whom he raised from the dead, and all he is wearing a linen cloth over his naked body. And he remained with him that night, for Jesus taught him the secret of the kingdom of God. That's a phrase right out of Mark 4:11. Now, this whole thing is bizarre. And, of course, there are some scholars who naturally think, oh, look, same guys, Marvin Meyer, Charlie Hedrick, and I could add John Dominic Crossan and other people to this list who think that this text is genuine. Well, I don't. I think it's a hoax. So did one of the first reviewers. When this book was published, 1973, and Morton Smith gave us his account, gave us the Greek text, gave us his English translation, gave us his commentary and his theory, Quentin Quinnell, in a review that appeared in 1975 in Catholic Biblical Quarterly, raised many objections, leaving a big question mark. Is this authentic? Is this a genuine letter, somehow, however it survived, written in the back of this book, copied from some old manuscript, evidently? Or is this a hoax? Well, you know, I think there's evidence it's a hoax. And a lot of people who knew the late Professor Morton Smith, he died in 1991 at the age of 75, they think that, in fact, it is a hoax. Jacob Neusner, pictured there, one of his students from the early 60s, he believes it is a hoax. Serious questions about Secret Mark. Morton Smith's name appears on the title page. Now, this is very strange. Have you ever gone into you've gone into libraries, right? Have you ever taken out your pen and wrote your name on the title page of the book? Probably not. Have you ever gone into a rare book room and somebody has a 450-year-old book? You go, oh, that's neat, and then you write your name on the title page? Morton Smith did. He wrote his name on it. I have a theory why. Because it's his book. Okay, it's his book. Now, I didn't take time when I showed you the color pictures, but if we looked at those color pictures, well, let's just do it right now. See if we can do this. Yeah. Okay, do you see what I see? See that spot? See these spots? You know what they are? Mildew and mold. Mildew and mold. Now think. This book has lived its life where? Where? Marsaba, Judean desert. How humid, how moldy and mildewy is the Judean desert? Not at all. It's the only book in their whole collection that has mold in it. You know why? Because that book is not from their library. It lived somewhere else. It lived in Europe or in North America, this old book. It got its mildew and mold somewhere else. And then somebody dropped it off in the library in 1958 when he visited. His name is Morton Smith. See what I'm saying? That's a piece of scientific information right away. There's actual other scientific information, including handwriting analysis, that shows that whoever wrote this was imitating the writing style. And in places, the way the Greek letters are written matches the way Morton Smith wrote certain Greek letters. I think Morton Smith wrote it. Have you ever seen this book? I have a copy of it. It's just great. It's called The Mystery of Marsaba by James Hunter. Published in Toronto, by the way, New York and Toronto, Evangelical Publications, first edition in 1940. I have a copy of it. You can get it on the internet. Well, it used to be available for $4 or $5, but I keep telling people about it, and they keep buying it, so you have to pay $10 or $12 now. But it is available, and it's a great little story. And you know what it's about? Stop me if this sounds familiar. It's about a Nazi plot, 1939, on the eve of World War II, to insert a bogus document in the back of an old book in the Marsaba Monastery that would supposedly disprove the resurrection of Jesus. Wow. And, of course, fortunately, British authorities proved it to be a nefarious Nazi plot, and so it was thwarted. But guess who is the hero of the story who proves that it is, in fact, a forgery? Scotland Yard Inspector Lord Morton. What are the odds? Wow! Isn't that amazing? In fact, there's an anachronistic reference to salt in the document. Let me think now. Oh, it relates to the Morton salts. Morton Salt Company controversy. It just goes on and on. It's quite clever, this hoax. Morton Smith leaves little breadcrumbs that point to him because he wants credit for his brilliance. But the thing that gives it away for me, that Morton Smith is the author of it, the real meat to this argument, is that there are four things that are most unusual about this document, this secret mark in Clement's letter, all this written in the back of this old book. And that's this. Number one, that phrase, mystery of the kingdom of God, as though it has something to do with sexual secrets. I mean, that is weird. Secondly, secrecy. Thirdly, an allusion to illicit sexual practice, Leviticus Holiness Code. And fourthly, Clement of Alexandria being dragged into this discussion. Now, I'll tell you, folks, right here, I'm a New Testament interpreter. That's my area of expertise. I have a commentary on the Gospel of Mark. I know a lot about Mark 4:11, the mystery of the kingdom of God. It relates to my doctoral dissertation as well. I have never heard of anyone taking the phrase, the mystery of the kingdom of God, which is in Mark 4:11. I have never heard of anyone, except Morton Smith, talk about that as having anything to do with sex. But Morton Smith, who was preoccupied with the subject, did. In his dissertation published in 1941 and in an article published in 1958, about the same time he went to Marsaba, he wrote the article in 57, it came out in 58. And lo and behold, while at Marsaba, he finds a document where those four elements come together. What are the odds? Now, if you're into the detection of forgeries and hoaxes, you know that one of the canons, the number one canon for detecting, apart from physical examination of the document itself, but the number one clue that it's a hoax, is if the finder of the document in question possesses knowledge of distinctive elements prior to the discovery of the document. See, that gives it away. Let me give you an example, a real live example. A professor from Princeton named Paul Coleman Norton published an article in 1950 called An Amusing Agraphon, where supposedly he found a page of Greek in the back of an old book, does this sound familiar, in North Africa during World War II. Alas, he didn't have his camera with him, he didn't get a picture, but trust me, I saw it, and I wrote down the Greek text, and he published it. And you know what it says? Jesus is teaching, and he tells his disciples that those who don't repent will be cast into outer darkness where there's weeping, wailing, and gnashing of teeth. And a disciple raised his hand and said, but Master, what about them that have no teeth? Now, you probably heard this as an Ian Paisley joke or something, I'm sure. But in any case, that's how I heard it 20 years ago. But in any case, and of course, this is ridiculous. Well, what about them that have no teeth? And then Jesus tells his other disciples, now don't laugh at this ignorant disciple, it's a good question. And he says, rest assured that those who leave this life and go into the next, and they be toothless, a third set of teeth will be provided. Third set, you know, baby teeth, adult teeth, and then eschatological damnation teeth, so that you can gnash your teeth properly. Okay, now this is ridiculous, and it's published in a learned journal in 1950. There's one problem, as we learn from the late Professor Bruce Metzger, taught for many, many years at Princeton Seminary. Bruce Metzger in the 1930s was a student of Professor Coleman Norton. And he remembers a joke with which Professor Coleman Norton regaled his students. And the punchline was, a third set of teeth will be provided. He was telling the joke 10 years before he found it. And so Professor Metzger concludes, there is no doubt that Coleman Norton made the whole thing up. Morton Smith has knowledge of distinctive elements, such as this ridiculous, this odd interpretation of Mark 4:11, mystery of kingdom God. This strange interpretation. Dragging in the discussion, Clement of Alexandria and the Leviticus holiness code and so on. And lo and behold, he finds a document years later where the same four elements come together. What are the odds? Well, I think the odds are exactly one chance in one that he is, in fact, the author of this whole thing. There are the two Marsaba books, the one on the left where Smith wrote his name. There it is in the upper right-hand corner of the title page of a rare book found at Marsaba, in the back of which we have those Greek pages. And then here's the book that I own by James Hunter. And so the mystery on the left was made public by Professor Morton. The mystery on the right was solved by Lord Morton. There you have it. Read it for yourselves and enjoy. There is, of course, the Greek text, a picture of it in the fictional book. Now, James Hunter never claims that this is genuine. It's just a fictional novel. It's actually not a bad read. And there it is on the left. So this fictional book inspired, in my opinion, at least two hoaxes, both of them following the similar pattern. Isn't that interesting? So don't be deceived. And yet, you'll hear scholars talk about secret mark. At last we know the truth. At last we have an older account of the Passion Week. My goodness. Here's analysis of Smith's handwriting, so on. These, by the way, are major league historians, distinguished scholars of history, professors of history, and they see through the whole thing as a hoax indeed. In fact, here is the book on the subject that came out just 3 years ago by Stephen Carlson, The Gospel Hoax, Morton Smith's Invention of Secret Mark. So we must say no not only to bogus gospels, but we must say no to the wrong context. I'm not going into that this morning, but Jesus was not a magician. Jesus was not a cynic philosopher. Jesus was not a Buddhist. Jesus was not a hoaxer and charlatan. And yet all of these views in various ways, semi-scholarly or popular, these views have been promoted in recent years. Why? Because they drift away from the New Testament gospels and play around with second and third century gospels, which, of course, are spurious and not written by eyewitnesses. What about the reliability, then, of these Gospels? If we agree, okay, you're right, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are our best sources. Do we have them well preserved? And the answer is yes, we do. They are old. They're numerous, the manuscripts. And most scribal errors are obvious, and they're not serious at all. And comparisons and cross-checks identify the original readings. There's the value of history and archaeology. And the book that Paul mentioned a little bit ago, I hope will help you on that, Jesus and the Ossuaries, the reality of archaeology and the light that they shed. Or the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that's that other little book, well, has essays on how the Dead Sea Scrolls shed light on the world of Jesus and his apostles. Time and time again, archaeological and textual discoveries clarify and support important details in the New Testament Gospels. In fact, I know of no significant discovery that points in the other direction. And I'll stop here. We have 2 or 3 minutes, but I would be happy to... Sometimes the truth can shake you up, as you see for poor old Kermit there. Have a seat, Kermit. What I'm about to tell you might come as a big shock. That's his x-ray. There is a hand inside of Kermit, and carefully looking at Secret Mark, I found Morton Smith's hand inside of it. But anyway, we got a couple of minutes. Q&A, please. I appreciate your attention, and your looks on your faces were encouraging. Yes, sir. Good for you. You're quite right. Okay, they are available. One of them is called the Complete Gospels. And so every single one of these that I've talked about, and many more, 30 altogether, are in this one book. I mean, I don't want to promote it, but since you ask, it's edited by Robert Miller. It's produced by the Jesus Seminar. about 10 or 12 years old. The Complete Gospels, edited by Robert Miller. And so you'll have the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, Secret Mark, all that stuff will be in it with a little introduction. I have students ask, you know, what about these other writings? I tell them, why don't you read them? And almost, well, always, I know of no exceptions. They come back and say, oh, wow, the church made a good call there, not including these. You know, so it's pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious. Anyone else? Other questions? Yes, ma'am. Well, the seminar was founded in 1985 by Robert Funk. Robert Funk died 3 years ago in August of 05. But the Jesus Seminar still carries on. It's published a couple of books, big books, and that's the five Gospels, where they color code Jesus' sayings. Red, he said it. Pink, it's close. Gray, it's doubtful. Black, no, he didn't say it. And they did that with the Acts of Jesus, too. So they have two major books where they color code and rate the authenticity of Jesus in these four New Testament Gospels and other stuff. The Jesus Seminar still sponsors talks, and they still do things, so they're still committed to confusing the public as much as they can. Yes, sir.
Okay. Not a little weird, but how do we really date things that are thousands of years old? And like, I heard that there's some circular reasoning to carbon dating and stuff, so how do we really do that?
Okay, how do we date? Good question, and this will be the last question. And you know what? It's not as hard as you think. There are a lot of ways we can date. We have found documents from antiquity, around 300,000 papyri alone, okay? And the papyri are old. We just find them in the old city dump, like that Oxyrhynchus place, tens of thousands of documents in the dump at one place, covered with this dry sand, and papyrus just lives on and on and on. It survives 30 feet deep in places. That's invaluable trash, okay? Now, some of these documents that are in this layer, they're dated. They actually have dates on them. It's a contract. It's an IOU. It's a personal letter in the fourth year of Caesar somebody. We can date them. Well, what we do is we take the dated documents and put them in a chronological sequence, and we see the style of handwriting. And we notice that, and these are professional scribes, so you don't have a lot of idiosyncratic stuff. You've got trained scribes who write a certain way, but the writing style changes as the years go by. Then we find documents that do not have dates. We look at the style of handwriting and we go, fits here. This one fits there. This one fits there. And so that's the circularity you're referring to. And so we find a document that has a certain handwriting and go, you know what? This fits the 2nd century AD. Or this fits the 1st century BC. That's how dating. And of course, carbon-14 is plus or minus 50, 60 years. So it's good for getting the right century, but that's about it. Carbon-14 will never say, well, that was written in the year 112. Carbon-14 can't do that. But good question. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to the next talk on the real Jesus. Thank you very much.